Coming up today at 1 on Hometown Heroes, this 89-year-old World War II veteran remembers having his helmet shot off while chasing the enemy across Germany. And he can't forget what he describes as the walking corpses he witnessed at a liberated concentration camp.
It is very devastating to know that humans can be so inhumane.
Experience history through the eyes of one Army veteran on Hometown Heroes, today at 1 on News Talk 580 and FM 105.9, brought to you by Humana, proud to honor our Hometown Heroes.
This is Hometown Heroes. Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the show where each time we take a trip back in time and listen to stories from our greatest generation. We want to honor our veterans for their service and for the sacrifices they've made. We want to preserve their stories so they're not forgotten, so we don't forget the price of freedom. And along the way, of course, we're educated about what World War II was really like, what some of our nation's greatest moments were like, and maybe we can put some of those ideas into practice today. We're going to visit with 89-year-old Clay Comer of Fresno, California, Army veteran of World War II, a guy who's lived in Fresno his entire life other than World War II. What was it like growing up in Fresno in the 20s and 30s?
It was a great, great town, and Fulton Street was the heart of everything, and the further north we would get, about Shields Avenue, although we did have a streetcar going from downtown area clear out to Pinedale area and the river, and one out to Roding Park in those days, because I rode that streetcar with my aunt. When I would go and stay with her, she'd say, well, let's go downtown, Clay, and she'd take us downtown and always go to the Mickey Mouse Club. So I'm a veteran of the Mickey Mouse Club also, as well as a World War II veteran.
Well, some people are saying the Mickey Mouse Club in Fresno, what's that all about? What can you tell us about that?
They showed at the Warner and the Wilson Theater different cartoons that was made in Hollywood, of course. We had a little axe on the stage of the theater. First, as kind of a warm-up, the guy who emceed it, he was wonderful. He was a Fresno State College student. He came here to go to college and ended up staying here. His name has come to me now. It's Elmer Tushoff. A lot of people of my age group would remember Elmer Tushoff as being the Al Radka of an earlier period of time. He was a musician also, and he played the great big tuba later on in his life, and he would have to set that tuba on a stool next to him, and then he'd sit on the stool next to his tuba, and he'd honk into that thing along with the other band members. And what a character he was, Elmer Tushoff. He was someone, in fact, it was Woody Laughlin one time said, Clay, who do you think should be Mr. Fresno? And I said, well, Elmer Tushoff. And his wife, Tilly, who was also a great patriot of Fresno and always interested in civic affairs.
As we talk about these war stories, I like to give people a glimpse of life before the war, wherever your hometown may be, and no matter how big or how small it might be. Fresno was a little smaller there, but so you're saying as a young kid of 12, 13 years old, you would go down to these movie theaters, which are still there. Wilson Theater is Cornerstone Church now. Warner's Theater is still preserved the way it was then. And you would see a stage show and something up on the screen and have this big adventure for the kids?
Yeah, and then they would have ongoing what they call serials, where the cowboy acts would end in a tight situation, and then you had to come back next week to see the conclusion of that great show. It was very entertaining. Although I did live out a little ways from the heart of downtown, I lived out west of downtown on West Olive between Marks and Valentine, but I still would come into town all the time and would visit with this aunt. She was the one that would take me down to the theater on the streetcar. So I remember the streetcars well in Fresno, and I also remember when they tore them up to do away with them and put in bus service. And guess what? This is World War II related. Much of the railroad tracks from the streetcars was taken and shipped to Japan, which we understood later was made into munitions for their effort in their war. So not everything was, 100% like it, we would like it to have been. But when we think about the fact that our Fresno streetcar tracks were maybe shot back at us in the form of bullets or even manufactured into guns.
Boy, see, that's a kind of example I'm talking about when I mention us being educated. Who would think that could happen? That's a story I haven't heard before. Let's talk about your story and your family's story. You had an older brother, and while you're still in high school, before America has entered World War II, he joined the Navy?
Yeah, he was in the Naval Reserve, and I remember out on our front lawn, he used to practice signal. He became a signalman, and he had to know all about Morse code, as well as the flag signals, as well as the flash semaphore, I think they call it, signals, where they can flash their messages from one boat to another. And Bruce became very proficient at that. I was still in the school. And so when he was doing 3 years of Naval Reserve, and you have to do 1 year of that time in the actual Navy. Well, he was stationed down in San Diego, as most or a lot of sailors were. And it was while he was up here on Fresno on leave, and he was not supposed to be more than 100 miles out of base, that Pearl Harbor was bombed. And so we got word of that. And instantly my folks jumped in the car, and me too with Bruce, went over to Chandler Field. There was no Hammer Field at that time. It was Chandler Field out there on Kearny Boulevard, and got him on a plane. I think they had to bounce someone off the plane to get Bruce on him, to get him back down to San Diego so he wouldn't be marked absent without leave. He had entered the war from that early point on a minesweeper, and finished his career on that minesweeper. Well, not finished his career, but got ground duty after, because he was had more points than most other sailors. And lo and behold, his minesweeper, the Hovey, went back out again in the Pacific, because that's where he operated, in the Pacific, and was sunk. While he was on that minesweeper in the Pacific, the Sullivan brothers, there were five of them, which were quite famous in World War II, two of the Sullivan brothers were on board his minesweeper ship. Well, they were five brothers in the Navy, and they petitioned some entity of our government to get together all of them on the same ship. Well, they were against that. The government was against that because they didn't want a catastrophe where the parents would lose all of the brothers, but it happened. All of the Sullivan brothers went down together, and Bruce had the privilege of knowing two of them, and it was quite the big newsmaker at the time was the fact that five Sullivan brothers were all lost on what type of ship, I don't remember, but it was probably a destroyer. I don't think it was a carrier, but it's not important. The important thing is that they were all five lost and made big headlines here stateside.
Yeah, that was November 13th, 1942. It was a light cruiser, the USS Juno, sunk in the naval battle of Guadalcanal. 687 men died, including those five Sullivan brothers, Albert, Francis, George, Joseph, and Madison. It sounds like Bruce could have been lost too without the timing of him getting off the ship. And let's talk about your own experience and even going back to December 7th. I can see why it's impossible to forget that day with all the events with your brother home and having to rush him back to the airport and all of that. Did you hear about it on the radio? How did you find out that Pearl Harbor had been attacked?
I guess that it must have come over on the radio. Obviously, even at that point, that we didn't have any television, for that matter. I don't think anybody did. So it would have had to have been that way that we heard it somehow on the radio. I don't think a neighbor come over hollering or something, Pearl Harbor has been bombed. No, there was nothing like that. We got word of it and realized that Bruce had to get back there. He has kept a diary of all of his activities on board the ship. And it really reads fine. I wish that other Navy people might contact me, because I would be happy to loan it to them, because it is so well written. How should I say? He was somewhat of a genius. When he got out of high school at the age of 15 at Fresno High, most of us are 17 or 18 when we graduate from high school. Not Bruce. He was 15 because he skipped two grades in grammar school. The guy was somewhat of a brain. And where this guy you're speaking to right now or listening to right now was not that way. I was just happy to be who I am and enjoy my life as a student, and enjoyed the Fresno High and the Warriors, and I really enjoyed that time. I don't think I missed a day of school. As kids now, they think it's a great thing to ditch. Well, it didn't even occur to me to ditch school. I was having too damn much fun there.
And I guess this was your senior year in high school when Pearl Harbor was bombed?
Yeah, it would have been the senior year. And so I thought, well, after I graduated then in June of 42, I thought, well, it's going to be just a matter of a week or two or whatever till they draft me. But I didn't turn 18 until July, even though I guess I was registered at that point. Well, I went to work for Beacon's Van and Storage at 301 South Van Ness Avenue. My father was the SunMade superintendent of the receiving side of SunMade. Many of the old timers in Fresno are mostly all gone now, but they would know Charlie Comer, my father. A lot of them at one point or a time had worked underneath him, especially those college students on seasonal, when they needed a seasonal work during the summer vacation, they worked at SunMade because that was the big plant here in Fresno. I worked at SunMade for about 3 or 4 days, and one of the old timers out there said, "Hey kid," he said, "they're hiring down at Beacon's." And so that night, riding home with my father, I didn't have a car. He said, "Oh, I know old man, Mr. Bill Holmes, who was the manager of Beacon's for years. Let's stop." And we put my name in at the counter there in Beacon's 301 South Van Ness. And the next night we came home from SunMade. My mother said, "They want you at Beacon's in the morning." I thought, well, that's neat. So he dropped me off there, and that's when I started. I still hadn't even turned 18 yet when I started at Beacon's. But I was tough enough that I could hold up my end with all of the old timers down there that lifted their pianos and anything you could have in an office or in a home. We moved it all. And I eventually, of course, did that on my own when I had my own business, which was called Courtesy Moving Service here in Fresno. And I've since sold that way back in 1985 and have been retired ever since. So I'm probably the senior most moving man in Fresno.
And what'd you just do a couple of weeks ago?
Yeah, I just moved myself. I moved myself a couple of weeks ago. As Paul says, trust me, it's been the toughest move I've had because of my own particular condition. As you can tell, I'm short-winded and I have to catch my breath as I speak. But there wasn't anything that I couldn't move or didn't move. I could even put a grand piano up in the truck all by myself, just knowing how to break it down and turn it on its side and dolly it up there and strap it to the truck so that it didn't get away. So I've done it all.
So you're doing that, but World War II would interrupt your moving career because they had to move you out of Fresno and stick a uniform on you. How did it happen that you ended up in the Army?
They did draft me, and a busload of us went down to somewhere on Broadway or 8th Street, and we were all transported then to the Presidio of Monterey, a very nice old facility, and that's where we got our uniforms, our toothbrushes, and our shaving gear, and got outfitted and learned to do a few right turns and left turns and about faces as we got oriented into the Army. It was strictly basic training. It wasn't anything combat oriented, just learning to be a soldier and take orders without question. So eventually then I left Presidio of Monterey and was sent down to San Diego to Camp Callan, which was opposite Pendleton Marine Base. That camp was a anti-aircraft 40 millimeter and also 90 millimeters. Well, I was assigned to the 40 millimeter group, anti-aircraft, and learned to identify planes that are approaching. And the reason I got into the anti-aircraft was, and they're doing examinations on us, they found out that I had what is called or known as stereoscopic vision. That means I can determine an object away from me, which if there are two objects coming toward me, which one is the closest? Well, I guess they figured that's important because you got to shoot the plane down that is nearest you first. And so that's what got me into the anti-aircraft. And I was doing just fine there. And we went out on what is called the Borrego Desert out east of San Diego and L.A. and did maneuvers out there and dug in and fired our 40 millimeters. That anti-aircraft period of time was interesting. In fact, while we were there, not out on the desert, but back in across the street from Pendleton, they used to tow out over the ocean a long sleeve that we were to fire at to practice firing so that you'd know how to lead a plane to make the hit. Well, some dumb GIs are so damn dumb, they fired at the plane instead of the trailing sleeve. And those people, I found out those pilots in there were pilots that had washed out, and it was the best kind of assignment they gave them, and which I guess was a form of punishment to them. So
they didn't shoot the plane down, just gave them a scare, huh?
I've never known of one being shot down, but I suppose it could have happened, but not on my watch, it didn't happen. And oh, by the way, speaking of San Diego, in that area, our camp was so just located a little bit north of the beautiful little town of La Jolla. Now, La Jolla is like, to us over here, the fanciest place is Carmel. So people of means live in Carmel, and people of means down in the southern part, many of them gyrate to La Jolla. We could see La Jolla from our camp. And when we got a leave one time to go into San Diego, us army guys, and went into a tavern to have a beer, and I'll be darned, there, I and maybe my buddy that was with me were the only two army guys. Everybody else was Navy. When the bartender gave us a change, he didn't just hand it to us. He threw it on the counter. We dog faces were dirt into those people in San Diego. We got very little respect, if none.
Making it clear it's a Navy town, huh?
Very definitely a Navy town. Army was not welcome there.
Well, it's time for our first break, but there's much more to come with Clay Comer, how he ended up in the infantry, and how he came face to face with the horrors of the Holocaust. Hometown Heroes will continue right after this. Our World War II veterans deserve a chance to see their memorial in Washington, D.C., and you can help send them there simply by renting a car. Between now and the end of October, visit any Enterprise Rent-A-Car location from Bakersfield in the south to Tulare, Visalia, Hanford, Selma, Fresno, Madera, Merced, all the way north to Sacramento. Tell them you heard this ad on Hometown Heroes, and Enterprise will donate 10% of your rental to Central Valley Honor Flight. Restrictions may apply. I'm sure you're familiar with Enterprise, but do you know why the largest car rental company in the U.S. is called Enterprise? The company's founder, Jack Taylor, was a decorated F-6F Hellcat pilot in World War II, flying off the deck of the Big E, the aircraft carrier USS Enterprise. Maybe I should get him on the show sometime and he can tell us how he earned the Distinguished Flying Cross. In the meantime, choose Enterprise for your next rental. Tell him you heard this advertisement on Hometown Heroes, and you'll be helping to send our World War II veterans on one more tour with honor.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today, 89-year-old Clay Comer of Fresno, California. When we left off, he'd been in the San Diego area in 1944, training to be part of the AAA, the anti-aircraft artillery, firing these 40 millimeters. And I imagine you're thinking someday you're going to have to leave the States and head overseas. Were you looking forward to that, or were you kind of dreading the day that you would have to ship out?
You know, I guess I wasn't smart enough to have any thoughts to that effect. I just was doing what they said to do and trying to do my very best. We succeeded in doing that very thing, and I remember now back up on when we went out on that maneuver out there on that, what is called the Borrego Desert. We were firing at this sleeve, and I asked the lieutenant in charge, he said, you got to stop every once in a while and give the barrel a rest if it gets too hot. And I said, well, what do you do when the plane keeps coming in? He said, you keep right on firing until that barrel just flicks out the projectile. So I thought that was kind of a cute explanation he gave me, because I could just see that barrel drooping down and flipping out the bullets.
So when was it that they sent you overseas?
What happened, I was having all this good time with the 40 millimeter unit. And during that period of time, the boys were over fighting the Germans, and they had a great big offensive the Germans did put on called, obviously and famously, the Battle of the Bulge. So they made a big effort to regain, I guess, whatever they had lost. It was during the winter that this took place. And there were many casualties of not necessarily wounded people, but were frozen. We weren't as accustomed to that kind of cold. So there were a lot of people back in the hospitals with frozen feet and so on. And so they needed infantry replacements badly. And so our little happy 40 millimeter outfit started headed down toward Texas to a camp. And the nearer we got to that camp, the more we realized, hey, that's an infantry camp. So we're going to be infantrymen, and we were. We took infantry basic. I remember on the parade grounds when we were inspected by what we call or were known as 90-day wonders. Those are the people with a little education that received a commission going in and become lieutenants, second lieutenants. When you stood at attention out there with your rifle for inspection, and that lieutenant reached for it to look down the bore and make sure it was clean. You better cut away your hands, and because if he snatches it out of your hands, the butt of that rifle might hit where you would prefer it didn't. So knowing this, it was the case, myself and a bunch of my buddies in the barracks, after we were turned in, we would practice doing different things. And one of the things we practiced was that rifle inspection. We got very proficient at cutting our hands away the instant that we saw a movement from the hand toward that rifle to inspect it. Sure enough, the guy comes in front of me and the second lieutenant, and I'm watching him real close, and he made a move for it, and my hands were gone. They were down at my sides. That rifle was falling, and we both caught it down by about my knee at knee height before it hit the ground. However, the rifle didn't hit the ground because we both caught it there, and it was embarrassing, of course, to him. And on the parade ground, it slanted off a little bit, and his helmet, I think it was probably a helmet liner, was knocked off in doing that maneuver, and it rolled down the parade ground, and so it was a very embarrassing moment for that second lieutenant. That was one of my memories of something that happened comically. Yeah, we used to just do all kinds of stuff, because I used to be a very active person doing gymnastics, so I taught people in the barracks after hours how to dive over a stack of foot lockers at least three high, maybe four high, and then hit the ground on the other side and roll where you don't hurt yourself. So those kind of things, and I did a certain amount of weightlifting too, and it served me well, of course, later when I got into moving business, because you had to have a little bit of strength.
I imagine it served you well as an infantryman too, with the 83rd Infantry Division, the 329th Regiment. I know you've got some close calls that you're going to describe. Were you concerned at all for your own well-being? Was there any thought in your mind that now that you are replacement infantry, you're going to be sent in situations you hadn't been in before, that you might not get to come home from this war?
No, I think that I can't speak for the other, but I just did what I was asked to do and tried to do my best at it, and never occurred to me that I wasn't coming back. I had a positive attitude, of which I continue today, which serves me well. And somehow or other, I just never was a fatalist and thought that anything would ever happen to me. And I was correct, although I did have some pretty close calls. And even my squad leader was shot and killed. And that was while we were chasing the Germans after the Battle of the Bulge. We pretty much had them on the run across Germany. And some of the attacks that we had to do were at Colonel Krebel's plan was a night attack. And so it was during one of these night attacks, we're approaching a village. Our squad is going up both sides of the road, and all of a sudden we're taking fire from in the village, and I hit the ground and I lost my helmet. And I thought, what the heck, where is it? I'm groping around in the dark, and I finally located my helmet, put it back on my head, and later in the daylight, when I examined that helmet, there was a bullet hole had entered, I think on the right-hand side, traveled between the helmet liner and the helmet, left a blue-gray streak right around the top of the helmet and out the opposite side. I never even knew that it had happened, but in all the confusion and the shouting and shooting, it never occurred to me, and I should never have parted with that helmet because it did save my life. So that was just one of a couple of other occasions, but that was the most, closest call that I had to losing my life was when I had my helmet shot off my head. And so trust me, the helmet liner was my saving grace, because had it not been there, it wouldn't have deflected the projectile of the bullet and caused it to spin, go around the helmet and slide out the other side. Believe me, that'll make you a believer right there. And I've had a number of things, in fact, that happened during my life, about not more than, say, five, that should have taken my life. And that was probably the most closest one, which brings up another story that I want to ask Paul if I want to get into. And I titled it My Guardian Angel, because too many times I should not be here today, which I am in pretty damn good shape. And it's all because of that guardian angel that took care of me on situations like that. Some of them happened while I was still a child, or a young man going to grammar school and things, and then the other incidents were military related.
Well, I think everyone's open to hearing about your guardian angel. I do want to follow up about that specific incident. It's just so everyone listening understands. So you're taking fire, you hit the ground, you don't realize your helmet's been shot off. It's just not there anymore. Is that because it was so loud and chaotic and there's so much going on that you didn't even feel or hear it?
Other than when I was on the ground, I guess I realized I didn't have a helmet on, and that's kind of a naked feeling when you're taking fire, and you know that that helmet is one of the things that can, between you and the enemy, that can save your life, and in my case, it did. I don't remember how we got out of that situation, but perhaps it was one of Colonel Crable's ideas that you're pinned down, and you have to overtake the enemy at the edge of the town, holding it there, so the command was passed throughout whatever other squads were there. At a signal, we would all get up and start what is called marching fire. You fire as much as you can, as fast as you can, in the direction where you're taking fire from, and they'll have to keep their heads down in order to not be hit. And so you come right up on them, and you finally got the rifles in their faces, so to speak, and they surrender. The Germans will. They're smart enough. They weren't like, we understand some of the Japanese were fanatical enough, they wouldn't even surrender. But at least the Germans know when it's time to give up, and they did. More than one occasion, we did a marching fire, and it paid off and got you out of a tight situation.
It has to be pretty nerve-wracking in the moment, though, to just stand up and march toward a spot where you know there are weapons and ammunition that can take you out.
Yeah, it is. And you stand side by side. You don't want to get in front of one another because you'd hit one another. So it was all marched in a line as tight as you can get and firing as much and as fast as you can with your M1s. You just waste a whole clip and then reload another clip as fast as you can from your bandolier that you got hanging around your neck that's made your neck sore from the weight of that ammunition that's hanging in your, around your neck, not just one, but one going one way and one going the other way to give you plenty of firepower when you needed it. And speaking of the M1 rifle, when I was given my first training there with the 83rd Infantry Division, the sergeant took a look at me, and I was fairly looked husky enough. He says, I want to give you a BAR, Browning Automatic Rifle. You can handle it. Because it was a little bit larger and quite a bit heavier. Many of the military people know a Browning automatic rifle. And I said, well, sir, that's nice, but I can't fire a BAR. And he said, why not? And I said, because my left eye is my master eye. I sight with my left eye. I shoot a rifle left-handed, and the BAR ejects the shells out the right-hand side. It would have ejected the shells right into my face. Oh, okay then. So I lucked out and didn't get a BAR. And that was another one of those situations where, had I been given a BAR, I could have lost my life simply because of that, because the enemy, if given the opportunity to take out one of the persons in the squad coming toward them, will take out the guy with the automatic rifle first. And so I wasn't carrying that. In fact, I was the assistant squad leader. As such, I brought up the rear, which is a nice place to be if you're... You don't want to be the lead guy, because I did have it one instance where our lead, Mr. McKay, Sergeant McKay, was shot and killed. That was not a pleasant time, of course. So I've witnessed pretty much everything in that type of tight combat. And thank goodness it was in the latter part of the war when we had the Germans pretty much on the run when the Battle of the Bulge took place. Had I been in there in the early years, big chance I would not be here today. So I'm thankful that I was the age I was and came into the Army when I did, and not in those early, tremendously precarious days that took a lot of our men.
And you mentioned Sergeant McKay being shot and killed. What did that do to you? Because obviously this is a guy that you've spent some time with, somebody that was more than just a number and a face to you.
You know, that's a good question. I don't know how that you can put something like that out of your mind, but I guess we have been given the ability, thankfully, to not let it change who you are and what you do. You take it as part of what's happening and what's going on. You just move on from there because you're so busy trying to preserve, I guess, your own life and do what is expected of you that you can't, and you don't have the time to stop and dwell on the loss of one of your squad members. So that, I think, is the best answer I can provide for you.
And you wanted to share more about your guardian angel, who you certainly felt was with you in that German village when your helmet got shot off.
Yeah, I remember too, one time when we were during this, this is daytime now, we were advancing and we see two Germans look like they're deserters run into a building, a house, and lock the door behind them real fast. So we approached that building. One of the fellows that carried in our squad, we referred to it as a grease gun because it resembled the grease gun that we used to lubricate our under our chassis of our cars. But it was a cheaply made 45 caliber machine gun that was furnished for the Army. And it was a dangerous weapon because if the bolt, they call it the bolt cover, the bolt picks up the round and fires it. But if that bolt cover is open, it can pick up a round and fire it. My friend standing next to me was hammering the butt of that grease gun against the door to get them to open it. The bolt cover was open, and so the bolt slid back, picked up a round and fired it right back in our direction. And it hit the guy standing next to me right in the shoulder. And of course that took him out of action, but it only missed me by the distance between him and me. So that was another example of the guardian angel being on my side. I'm sure that some of the fellows that were in the Army know what I mean by the grease gun. I gave a very poor description of it, but it was a 45 caliber, a cheap version you might see of the old 45 caliber Tommy gun.
So you get over there. In early 1945, the war in Europe ends in May of 1945. Was it pretty much constant movement, constant combat for you over those months?
Well, actually, what took place there, because at that point we did have the Germans on the run. Our 83rd Division had our segment of Germany to cover, and we're going across it so fast and the Germans in retreat that sometimes we had to ride on anything that we can to just keep up with their retreat. I remember riding on top of a Sherman tank with not only myself, but all kinds of GIs on top of that tank, and them riding in anything they can. In fact, we had been nicknamed the Ragtag Circus, pursuing the Germans in their retreat. They finally got on the other side of the Elbe River. We went through up to where we could see the searchlights from Berlin, and we were told to stop. The Russians were going to take Berlin, and we were to withhold and stop there. Big mistake, but we did. But it was pretty chaotic when we were crossing Germany and met with, at least our segment, met with very little resistance once they were on a run. And I'm sure that we did our share of capturing the Germans. And, of course, we overran prison camps that the Germans had interned prisoners, and it was a pretty sad sight to see them in their condition that they were kept.
Yes, I need to stop you there for now. It's break time. When we come back, we'll hear about what Mr. Comer witnessed in April of 1945 at that concentration camp in Langenstein. The rest of Hometown Heroes right after this. They say a picture is worth a thousand words, but when it comes to making my mouth water, I don't need a thousand words, just two of them. Mongolian beef. Okay, two more. Ming's Restaurant. And I guess if you want to know where to find it, I should give you two more. Las Banas. That's where I grew up. And I'm guessing Las Banas is somewhere you pass through every now and then. And if you drop in for the Mongolian beef, you might start calling it what I have for years. My favorite place to eat. Period. He may not look old enough for this to be true, but the owner, Paul Sito, has been working his magic in the kitchen there for 45 years now. It's all delicious. If you're a garlic fan, try the Baja shrimp and thank me later. But the Mongolian beef is absolutely unmatched. The flavor, incredible. The texture, tremendous. I can't do it justice with words. You just got to go taste it. One word of caution, do not go on Monday because Ming's is closed on Mondays. So pick another day, tell them I sent you, and let me know if your taste buds enjoy it as much as mine do. That's Ming's Restaurant, 435 West Pacheco Boulevard in lovely Las Banas, California. If you are a World War II veteran and you have not been to the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C., Honor Flight wants to take you there, free of charge. The sooner you submit an application, the sooner Honor Flight can get you to your memorial. In Kern County or the Central Coast, call Lily Marsh at 661-544-VETS. That's 661-544-VETS. Or go to honorflightkerncounty.org. For Fresno, Madera, Merced, Mariposa, Kings, or Tulare counties, check out CV Honor. Honor Flight, CV as in Central Valley, cvhonorflight.org, or call Al Perry at 559-970-9853. That's 559-970-9853. Maybe you're the son or daughter of a veteran and you'd like to go along as a guardian. There are applications for that too, and there are other ways you can help. Donations to Honor Flight are tax deductible. We all owe our freedom and liberty to the men and women who put their lives on the line for it. Let's all come together now behind Honor Flight and give our veterans one more tour with honor.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today, 89-year-old Clay Comer of Fresno, California. He served with the 83rd Infantry Division during World War II. And in April of 1945, while chasing retreating German forces across Europe, Mr. Comer experienced a few hours that he would never be able to erase from his memory. He and his fellow soldiers came across the Langensteinswieberger concentration camp, where in the final year of World War II, the Nazi regime had sent nearly 7,000 prisoners into forced labor. Many were of Jewish origin. There were also non-Jews of 17 different nationalities, and they were there in brutal, starving conditions, forced to dig an underground tunnel where the Germans could construct jet aircraft and V-2 rockets. I know you weren't there for very long, Mr. Comer, but what did you see?
We saw pretty much skin and bones and just walking corpses, really. They were just on the verge of not making it another 6 months at the most. They were fed just enough and given enough liquid to keep them alive. But beyond that, they were walking, I hate to use the term, but they were walking dead. And they were so grateful when they were released from these prison camps that the Allies, the Americans, had freed them, and that they were going to finally be liberated from their terrible conditions that the Germans had caused them to have.
Yeah, and as I understand it, this was one of those camps that was a forced labor camp, where not only they're being starved and pretty much tortured, they're being forced to work like 16 hours in a day. So you saw a lot of gratitude on their faces, it sounds like.
Yeah, that's correct. And even though that we could see that they were rejoicing to be freed, and that knowing that we were the ones who liberated them, and they had no longer reason to fear, and yet we couldn't stay there and enjoy that and celebrate with them, because we had to keep on moving because we were still pursuing the enemy. And this was just overrun a camp. Now, we probably didn't spend more than 2 or 3 hours realizing who these people were, and I'm sure that our rear echelon type of took care of the needs that they had as best they could with what they had to give them, to make sure that they saved them from perishing and any further than I'm sure that many of them had in the camp. It was a time that you just don't have time to really realize what you have just liberated and what you've seen. You're too busy going and doing whatever your job was. As a foot soldier, you just do whatever you're told to do, and you do it as best you can.
I'm guessing then, and again, this is just a leap of my brain trying to put the pieces together. I imagine after the war, when you're back home and the Nuremberg trials are happening and all this, then you're probably putting two and two together and said, hey, I saw some of that.
Well, I did see the Nuremberg trials after the war was over, and we were in what is known as occupation. So one of the things that we were offered in occupation, and by the way, we're occupying a German prison camp, and I was a bread ration sergeant assigned that anyway, to figure out how much bread all these prisoners, the Germans, were to get.
Let's straighten this out for people, because before, the camp you were just talking about, where you saw the walking corpses, those were prisoners of the Germans. Now you're talking about after America has won the war, and you're part of the occupation force on an American-run camp holding Germans as prisoners.
Yeah, I'm glad you straightened that out, because I can see where that would be quite confusing had you not taken hold and straightened that out for me.
And you know what, before we get there, I'm sorry for bouncing around. Even though you were only there for a few hours at this camp, was it a shock to your system? I mean, had you ever imagined that human beings could live in those kind of conditions?
No, it was a total shock. The only devastation that was ever worse than that was when you're advancing and you do pass over casualties of the enemy that were killed, and they're still, bodies are still there, and you're still advancing it and just passing them by. And I guess some of our people eventually take care of that. But as an infantryman, that's not part of your job. So you just keep moving. But to see these, as I referred to them earlier, I think as waxing corpses, it is very devastating to know that humans can be so inhumane, even in time of war. But that's the difference between a dictatorship under Hitler and our democracy of America. We never treated any prisoners like that. In fact, the people that we had that were prisoners from not only Germany, but Japan, and I'm sure a lot of Italian prisoners too were taken. And they were never treated like that because we were civilized Americans. And it is so disheartening to know that mankind can be so cruel to the fellow mankind. And it is not the men in the army or there in their army. It is what we call unavoidably and mistakenly leaders. Trust me, anybody that would advocate treating people like they did, and they're not leaders, they're destroyers of mankind. And it's going on today throughout a lot of the world, parts of the world. It's horrible to know that I live in a world that we still have to kill somebody and blow them up, all this kind of stuff. It just doesn't make sense to this old man. I can't conceive that our leaders can't be leaders instead of destroyers. And they should know by example of what happened in World War II, as well as some other wars, that it doesn't pay to be other than a good leader, someone who wants to better their country and the fellow man in their country. Instead of, even in recent years, we hear that leaders of their country are killing their own people. How insane can our society have become? It's just very disheartening to know that I've even lived in a time when this has happened. It should never have happened, and it's still happening.
Especially when you were part of a generation who fought to, in theory, to end that kind of thing. Tell me about the rest of the war for you. When was that moment where you realized, you know what, it's over, I don't have to fight anymore?
Yeah, we were holed up in the town across the river from Dusseldorf, which was a great big industrial city in Germany. And the town right across the river was called Neuss. I think it's pronounced Neuss. And I was up in a factory building, and we were still shelling across into Dusseldorf because it was one of the last cities in all of Germany to surrender and give up. We could even see the shells bursting in the factories over there in Dusseldorf. We got our times to lay down in the factory that I was in. I went up a stairway, and then it makes a landing, and it goes up another direction. And the landing is about 5 feet by 5 feet, and I thought, I can get some sleep here. So I laid down, and I took off my boots. No way could I go to sleep until I put my boots back on again, because it felt so unnatural to have the boots off. And so it was shortly after that, and it was while we were there held up in Neuss, that Germany did finally surrender completely, and the word got out that we were no longer at war with Germany. So that was a great time.
But you stayed there in the occupation force, and as you said, you worked in a camp where German prisoners were held. What were your interactions like with these defeated enemies?
Here again, we're dealing with people that are generally pretty sane. Germany had a great reputation for being an advanced society, as well as we. And so in the prison camp, you have people who are as knowledgeable, I hate to use the word intellectual, as you are. They were not combative. By this time, they realized, you know, they're prisoners. It doesn't pay to try to kill any more Americans, nor did it occur to us to mistreat any of the Germans. And there was one guy, I still recall, his name was Howie, H-O-W-I-E, I guess, Howie. And we would have arguments, and because so many of the foreign countries over there do speak English as a second language, unlike us who hardly ever learn a second language, they do over there. And so Howie and I would have some pretty good arguments about his way of life and his Der Führer. And so we'd actually have some wrestling matches, which I loved to wrestle because I had pretty good strength for a guy my age. So it wasn't a bad time. It was just time doing time until such time that our governments could get things settled down to where we could get back home again.
And what was it like to get back home again? What do you remember about that?
Well, I remember getting back home. When I went overseas to join the 83rd Infantry, I went over on the Queen Elizabeth, which at the time was the largest ship afloat and a little bit larger even than the Queen Mary. A lot of people mistakenly said, well, the Queen Mary was the largest ship. Well, yeah, it was up until the Queen Elizabeth was built, and it was a little bit bigger. And we went over in under 5 days, four days and something, to Glasgow, Scotland, where they docked. They couldn't dock at just any place because they were so big. And they never traveled in convoy. They always traveled alone, because in a convoy, you can only go as fast as the slowest ship. Well, the Queen Mary and the Queen Elizabeth would both be at the bottom of the ocean had they had to go in a convoy instead of by themselves. Well, they were powerful enough that they could get up to some pretty good high knots and outrun most sub challenges. And of course, the word was out that we had been chased by a sub. And so when we landed in Glasgow, Scotland, and then transferred to a smaller boat to go to Le Havre, France, to eventually complete that joining up with the 83rd Infantry. But then coming back, it was a little bit different situation. We had to come back on, the ship I came back on was called Blue Ridge Victory. It was just a relatively small ship, and it took us a little over 10 days to make it from Bremerhaven to land in New York. That trip back of 10 days was a heck of a lot longer than that going over there in 5 days. I used to get up in the bow of the ship, right up in the very nose of the ship, where I could look over the railing and straight down where the hull was cutting the water, and I'm counting the yards as they went by, thinking I'm just that much closer to home. That was the first time I got choked up, a little emotional, thinking about that. Because that was all important to me to get back.
What was your reception like in Fresno when you got back home?
Well, it was wonderful. When I was discharged up at Camp Beale, which was just north of Sacramento, there was no direct transportation that I knew of to get back to Fresno. I think I rode a streetcar through Sacramento and out the south end of Sacramento on my way to Fresno. I caught a ride with a truck driver for a while and hitchhiking, and that's how desperate I guess I was. I couldn't wait till there was a train or a plane or anything, which I couldn't have afforded anyway. So I came home, and then when I called my parents, they came and picked me up, and of course they notified my girlfriend, which we're still married, 67, 68 years later, and Glennis and my parents came, and they saw me there. Oh, it was at the bus station, Greyhound bus, that's right. And I remember my mother got a little bit disturbed later on when she wasn't the first to give me a hug, but my little girlfriend, Glennis, ran ahead and greeted me and gave me a big hug. So it was wonderful to be back. And when I got back, unlike many of the stories that we hear nowadays, we got back home to the where I grew up, got in the closet, got my pants and shirt, civilians, and put them on, took off my uniform, and I still have the Ike jacket, even though I have just recently turned it over to a grandson.
But you still fit in it.
Yeah, I can still wear that Ike jacket, and I have pictures to prove it. I transitioned from a combat veteran to a civilian not even overnight, but from the time I got home till I took off my uniform and put on civilians and went back to living the life of a civilian. I didn't need any a shrink to tell me what I'm supposed to think or how I'm supposed to feel. Maybe I wasn't smart enough to get all upset, and that might be the answer. It pays to be ignorant, and in that case, I think I qualify.
Well, you mentioned Glennis. I want to hear that story, and that's where I was going to go next. I know we're almost out of time here, but so you met her before you went overseas. Was she sending you letters the whole time you're racing across Germany?
Very definitely. You bet. Real quickly on Glennis, and I shouldn't be quickly with her because she's special. When I was still here before getting drafted, Hammerfield had started, and there were GIs all over the Camp Pinedale, and there were a number of different installations around. And the Rainbow Ballroom was the big place for soldiers and women to meet. And so I'm at the Rainbow Ballroom in my civvies. I hadn't yet been drafted. And everybody else there was from either Hammerfield or Camp Pinedale or somewhere here in Fresno in uniform. And I was the only guy in the civvies. But as a young man, I still had early gray hair. And nobody ever challenged me and said, what's the matter with you, kid? Are you 4F? No, nobody ever challenged me. So I'm at the Rainbow, and I look up on this riser a couple of steps up that circled around most of the Rainbow. And here's this pretty girl up there. And four or five or more men were circled around her at the bottom of the stairs. And I went over there, reached right through those guys and took her hand and said, she's going with me. And I come to find out later on that she was only 15. And I was 18. And so when I found out how young she was, I told her, don't tell my friends how young you are. It was something that was important at that time. So she stayed faithful to me the whole time, as I to her. No intentions of ever getting married before getting back out of the military. So when I came back, it wasn't long after that that we married and raised three great children. A son first, and then a year and 11 months later, we had a boy and a girl, twins, and all of them are just doing fine, and all of their children are excellent. Not anybody has ever disgraced us in any way. Great family, and Glennis has been a great role model for them. And in fact, so much so to the point that in 1950, at Mother's Day, always they select someone for the city of the county of Fresno to represent the mothers. In 1950, Glennis was chosen Mother of the Year. So that's an honor that we've always honored. And I think you can see by that what a quality person she is. And she was half of my business when we run Courtesy Moving Service. After I got back into the moving business, I then opened up my own company called Courtesy Moving Service. And Glennis ran the inside proficiently, and I ran the outside in training the men and working the moving jobs. So it's been a marvelous, marvelous period of our life. All the way through, I have no complaints about anything.
Do you have any advice? Because I don't think I'm the only one listening that wouldn't mind being married for 67, 68 years.
Well, make darn sure that the person that you're going to marry is someone that you do truly love, and that they do truly love you, because I think too many marriages start just because it's a thing to do. Well, my daughter or my girlfriend over here, she got married. I want to get married too. It's a lot more than just that. You better damn well know what you're getting into. It's a lifetime commitment. And when you take the marriage vows, for better or for worse, in sickness and in health, you better be prepared to honor those. And so many times now, people don't have that commitment that we were taught as young people. Whatever you say you're going to do, do it. Don't goof off. You have to be true to yourself. That is so important to a successful marriage. So thank you for asking.
Well, thanks for answering. And thank you for serving our country and for sharing some of those stories with us. If you at home want to see photos related to Mr. Comer's story and proof that he still does fit into that Eisenhower jacket he wore nearly 70 years ago, get on Facebook and punch in Hometown Heroes Radio. Thanks for spending this hour with us. I'm Paul Leffler, telling you once more what you've heard before. Freedom is not free.
A high school where 98% of graduating seniors go to college, where success on the SAT and advanced placement or AP classes outpaces almost every other school in the valley. Home to a student newspaper that hauls in national awards on an annual basis. Its sports teams capture section championships. Have you figured it out yet? The school is Fresno Christian, and it's not just a high school. Fresno Christian offers a complete K-12 curriculum delivered by supremely qualified, experienced teachers who connect with their students personally, intellectually, and spiritually. Go to FresnoChristian.com to learn more about the value of a truly Christ-centered education. And if you want to see for yourself, call 299-1695 to schedule a campus visit. Whether it's kindergarten, high school, or anywhere in between, you'll get a genuine feel for what Fresno Christian's commitment to excellence could mean for your student. That number again, 559-299-1695. Fresno Christian Schools, education with a higher purpose.
Is there anything else that you want to share about your time in the service and why you're proud of that today?
Well, there probably is, and I don't want to take any more of your time because it's been a real pleasure here. The thing that I find is quite fascinating, just now it popped in my head, is that over the years I have come up with some pretty doggone good ideas about traffic and driving, and I've tried to present it, but this is long after I'm in my 60s and so on and so on. And they don't want to hear it. They do not want to hear it. Oh, you're old. You don't know what you're talking about. I went to college. I'm smart. I know all about that. And so that is very disturbing, and it's such a refreshing pleasure to now to have Paul Loeffler here talking to me, that I'm able to express myself. It's a complete turnaround of what I've experienced since I've become a senior citizen. But once you become a senior citizen, you're pretty much, you're over the hill, baby. You don't know anymore. Well, let me tell you, it's not true. I have a lot more to offer if I could find an ear. But the ear goes closed whenever I try to talk to them. And I've seen it happen over and over again. I've written to different things, and I'll get, thank you, Mr. Comer, for your letter. And we'll consider it, and we'll pass it on to somebody. It's that type of pushing you aside once you become old that is a little bit disturbing when you know that your brain is still functioning.